Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
All are welcome. We're glad you found us. Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. And today is the third week in our series on the subject of aspects of love. And I welcome the author of the new book entitled A Theology of Love, Reimagining Christianity Through A Course in Miracles, A Spirituality Based on Love, Not Fear. And goodness knows we need that right now. The author, Richard Smalley, is also the author of several books on esoteric spirituality, especially as it pertains to the Western spiritual and theological tradition and understanding. He has degrees from Harvard and Oxford universities and was the editor of Gnosis magazine for many years. He's a frequent contributor to many journals and is currently the editor of Quest, Journal of the Theosophical Society in America. His teaching on consciousness, the inner self, and new theology and the supremacy of love are highly regarded by his peers. So it's a joy to welcome Richard Smalley to today's show. Welcome. Glad you're with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's delightful to be here.
You know, with your background and credentials, I was looking forward to a well-thought-out and well-argued book, and I wasn't disappointed. That was part of the fun of reading it. It's a page-turner for the people like me who love these sort of things, but I think it's a page-turner for anybody that's serious about, you know, where we are in our Western tradition, not just in religion, but in spiritual awareness. And it's basically in two parts, isn't it? You've got the problem, so to speak, quote, which is which you term fall, which is, you know, pretty much the traditional term. And then you have an attempt at a solution, which you called regeneration, which fascinated me because Charles Fillmore, the co-founder of Unity, and that was one of his terms, and it's an old New Thought term, this regeneration of our beings, of our awareness. So let's talk about the first part first, the fall, or fall in general. I don't want to say the fall. Why have we fallen?
Well, to begin with, I mean, human beings are animals that think something is wrong. That is almost universal. Christians put it in terms of sin, Buddhists and Hindus tend to speak of it in terms of a kind of loss of consciousness, which I think is worth considering. So we all have this sense of why something is wrong. So why? Well, one esoteric interpretation of Genesis, and there are many, is that, of course, the primordial man and woman ate of the fruit, the tree of knowledge, good and evil. Now, that is to say, they wanted to know good and evil. And the only way you know something is by experiencing it. So they had to come down to a realm, which is the physical realm that we live in or appear to be live in. And what did God say to them? All right, if you really want to do this, you're going to have to go to a realm where it hurts to have babies and you have to work hard for a living. In travail shalt thou give birth. By the sweat of thy brow shalt thou earn thy bread. That's exactly what the Bible is saying.
Right.
So there's no talk of hell. And the thing I can say about you, having talked to you, without having talked to you, I can say this about every last one person who's listening to this, and every person who will ever listen to this, and I can say this infallibly, is that you've known some good and some evil in your life. I know the proportions vary wildly. At least that is the experience. And then the question is, what is past that? And that is perhaps, you asked about the fall, so that is where we are as far as that question is concerned.
And you know, you can put a sort of a negative spin on it, can't you, saying something badly went wrong, which is sort of the premise of the book in a way, that there's something needs to be corrected. Or you could see it in a different light, perhaps, which is just, you know, like Alec Butterworth, Unity minister and writer, he said that it was a fall forward, you know, that the fall into knowledge, although it's problematic, you know, and it leads to sort of dualism, you know, you're not sure if we were on the side of good or evil, whatever, it's necessary, you know, in other words, you have to lose it to find it. So it's a necessary fall in a sense, isn't it? You know, you mentioned in the book that animals, you know, don't really worry about these things as far as we know. Only human beings do. And maybe that's because we are this strange creature, you know, that arose from, you know, the animal and is now has some degree of awareness or consciousness and is no longer at home, you know, in the world, so to speak, in the natural world. And yet it's still tied to it in so many ways. So it leads to that sense of who am I? What am I doing here? So maybe it's not so much that, you know, the human condition is flawed in some way, but it's gestating into something greater, perhaps. I mean, that's my sort of unitive, positive-minded take on it. You know, you have the image in the book, and it's a very powerful image of the man in the mirror box. You know, he creates himself a box, and then he puts mirrors on all the inside of the box, and jumps in the box, closes the lid, and all he can see is, you know, an infinity of himself, basically, and which is, you know, quite a good analogy for, you know, the undeveloped soul, if you like. We project onto others what's really within ourselves, etc., and drive ourselves mad. My question is, you know, is it really that bad? You know, is the human condition, you know, as horrific as the mirror box would suggest?
Well, I think we have to at least be aware of the fact that many people go through day-to-day life regarding it that way.
Right.
And that's pretty much a common feeling. So to brush past that may not be the ideal thing. But in regard to what you've been saying, there is this view that there is some kind of great kind of cosmic mistake. That
right.
Something went badly, terribly wrong. That is a fairly universal view in the world religions, whether you call it dukkha or illusion or suffering or whatever in the Eastern traditions. So that is one side of it. And I don't think it can be just brushed aside. There is the other side of it, which you mentioned, which is that this was kind of a necessary fall or descent. That is to say, the human race or the soul or the spirit, if you like, descended into this plane of materiality to experience certain things and gain certain knowledge that it could not gain in other higher realms. That is also a view. I work for the Theosophical Society and edit its magazine, and that is the classic theosophical view, that this is all just a necessary process.
Right.
My own view is that I would be very, very cautious about jumping to the conclusion that either one of those is correct. I think both of those probably have some validity, and we're dealing with things of a cosmic proportion beyond, you know, stars and galaxies. So it could look one way from one perspective, and it could look another way from a different perspective. I would not want to say which of those was absolutely right or absolutely wrong, and I doubt anyone could say with any real authority that it was one or the other.
Well, and I think all constructs or frameworks are useful, right, within their own limitations. You know, they illuminate something and then obscure something else. I mean, you mentioned Jung in the book. You know, Jung was wonderful describing certain things. You know, I think he was great on the archetype, things like that. But then in some ways, he obscured things, and some I can't agree with everything that he puts forward. So, but that's okay, you know, because I get enough out of his insights to deepen my own thought experiment, if you like. And I think it's the same with religions in general. You know, I don't think any one religion, you know, has a lockdown on ultimate truth, right? That's why we have so many religions. Why it's fascinating to study them, because each illuminates an aspect of the human condition and the movement, beyond that in a certain unique way. And but you, of course, in your book, You spend a lot of time on the Western theological systems, and you have you're saying basically that where we are at the present time, especially in liberal Protestant Christianity, you know, we're at a poor state, right? Because we've got to throw out the basis of the religious endeavor, you know, the theology of it, and have never really answered the attack of science, really. It's we're still apologizing in a way, or saying, well, don't think about it, just have faith, because that's where I grew up. You know, I wasn't allowed to question anything. If you mentioned something that didn't fit, you say, well, you have to go out on faith, you have to make the leap of faith, which always annoyed me, you know, because it seemed like a cop-out. And we still seem to be there, don't we? Or the other response is, the fundamentalist response, where we have a sort of a zealous and a joyous return to the old certainties, right, without really questioning them.
Well, I'm not so sure it's joyous, but I agree with you. Another, well,
seems
I mean,
to
there,
be
there's
sometimes.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of what you say, and science itself is being hit with its own inconsistencies and contradictions, and it is in for a very serious intellectual revolution over the next generation. That is a long topic in its own right.
That's true.
I don't think we need to get into it.
No,
but,
probably not.
Yeah. Well, the thing about it is that conventional Christianity, particularly after the Reformation, hung a great deal on the literal truth of the Bible. And scholars starting from the 18th century on started to say, well, let's see how true this is. And since then, they've put an enormous amount of work into saying, well, what did Jesus really do, as opposed to what they said he did or what his disciples put in his mouth afterward. And after all of this work, there are libraries written on this very subject. The most learned authorities simply don't agree. Some of them, the more conservative ones, want to say he did virtually everything in the Gospels. The more liberal ones, like the Jesus Seminar, take pretty much everything out, which leaves a rather mysterious Jesus. I wrote another book on this subject called How God Became God, What Scholars Are Really Saying About God in the Bible. In the Old Testament, they decided they did biblical archaeology. And that started in the early 20th century, and they decided to go back and dig in the Holy Land and find out, they expected to validate the historical truth of the Old Testament, but they didn't. What they found is a lot of things forget about Genesis. We're talking about Moses, David, Solomon. There is no historical record of any of these people. Solomon supposedly ruled from the Euphrates to Egypt. Well, if you ruled that much, you would leave a monument or two, and there are none. It's only around 850 BC, for reasons we could go into, but we probably shouldn't, that the Old Testament starts to jibe with archaeology. They hung so much on this truth, and they realized, we can't hang this anymore. I mean, it was an act of remarkable intellectual honesty on the part of these liberal scholars, but they have really no idea what to put in its place. And so they've, in the liberal and mainstream churches, they've kind of just let people kind of go on believing what they've always believed, but it always seems very half-hearted. The fundamentalists, evangelicals, say, well, it's all literally true. Well, unfortunately, the problem with that argument is, no, we know that a lot of it isn't literally true. So that is the impasse that Christianity has today. You know, the Catholic Church, relies, whatever we say, we're the Catholic Church. We have the franchise of God's grace on earth, so whatever we say goes. In a way, they have less of a problem with it, conceptually, but they have lots of other problems that we need not allude to here.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned the great breakthrough that happened, 2,500, 3,000 years ago, when we had all these, the founders of all these great religions and other philosophical systems sort of arising in all parts of the world, whether it be Confucius or Lao Tzu in China, or the Buddha and others, the Upanishads in India, and then the great religions of Judaism and the Greek understanding and philosophy, all so many great people, so many great writings, right? And yet we're still following these, 2,500 years later. It's an inbuilt impasse and stumbling block, isn't it? When you make them artifacts, of total truth, it's really tough to move forward then, you hate to jettison them because they have some truth, in fact, a lot of truth, but they also have these inbuilt problems and contradictions, like you mentioned, humankind's going to be held back eventually if we, I think it happens in America too, because we always refer to this Constitution or Bill of Rights, as if it is the one and only arbiter of anything that makes sense, and that's an inbuilt problem. Where I'm from in Britain, we don't have a written constitution, which, again, can be problematic. But on the other hand, it has the gift of not having getting locked into one system, that becomes a sort of a monolithic thing.
Well, as far as the Constitution goes, many people here venerate the Constitution just up to the point when their favorite pet politician decides to violate it. But that also is another very long and unfortunately very unpleasant subject that I don't want to go into.
Well, let's not be unpleasant. Yeah. I was just drawing an analogy between how things can be monolithic and problematic as a result.
But a lot of it, what you're saying, I think has to do with the concept of the astrological ages. I mean, everybody's heard of the age of Aquarius that we are entering, or in my view, have entered, and the age that before it, and these ages, around 2,000 odd years, was the age of Pisces. And when the age of Pisces began, say arbitrarily around 600 BC, we see the rise of the great religions, what Karl Jaspers, the German philosopher, called the Axial Age. It was when all of these figures came. So religion is, what we call religion, is the religion of the Piscean Age. Before that, religion was completely different. In fact, if someone from the previous age came and looked at what we're doing now, they would call us atheists. You know why? Because their religion was constituted almost entirely of animal sacrifice. You see this even in the Bible. Well, that age passed. Nobody practices animal sacrifice. So they would think, we don't do that, so we're not honoring the gods, so we're atheists. Now, we're at the end of the Piscean Age. This is the end of the Piscean Age. And what you see, it is said that a sign of the passing of the age is that the old gods are mocked. This happened in classical antiquity. Christianity arose when the Greeks and Romans could no longer take their gods seriously and made fun of them. And what do we see? We see all sorts of people making fun of religion, Jesus, Mary, the church, in ways that would have been unthinkable, say, in the mid-20th century. So this is a sign that these religions are passing. They served a function at a time, but they're going. And so now we have to look forward and see, what we might replace it with. And I think that the future of that is still very, very dim, very hard to see, but it's obviously happening, and it's happening on a daily basis.
Right, which is a very interesting subject because, you know, in the midst of that, it's hard to see clearly because, you know, it's like when you're in the middle of anything, you know, you don't get that benefit of hindsight, right, of 20/20 vision. And so it seems very confusing. It seems like, you know, certain, fundamentalisms are rearing their heads, you know, but maybe that's a last hurrah. I don't know. Maybe they are dying, but so they seem to be very powerful. But then you get, you know, politicians co-opting certain aspects of religion for their own usage, not just in the Middle East, but here in America. So it's a very confusing time. People like Oprah, you know, the New Age, New Thought people, you know, are saying, oh, no, the new is coming. There's going to be this breakthrough. And like everything in the modern world, there seems to be that, divisiveness around it, right? There's the them and us aspect, which actually is something I want to talk about maybe in the second segment, you know, in terms of the course, because unfortunately, I don't think it means to be dualistic, but it appears to be, at least from my perspective. So we'll talk more about the Course in Miracles in the second part. I wish I could see more clearly, but I guess it's okay if I can't, right?
Well, you can, or you know, you either can or you can't. I threw out some ideas in one chapter of my book, which is called The Age. The chapter is entitled The Age of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The book is, you know, a theology of love. But you know, even that is rather speculative. I think, the most important practical consideration has to do with the problem of authority. Now, you'll remember a verse in the New Testament that says, and the people wondered at Jesus, for he spoke as one having authority and not as the scribes. And today's scribes are the Bible thumpers, the chapter and verse people who existed in his time, who existed in our time, who existed in all times. So the idea that Jesus spoke from authority rather than chapter and verse Bible thumping. But that verse, another aspect of that verse is the people themselves had to recognize authority when they saw it. Meaning, in my view, that you give authority. Only you give authority. And if you're being, shall we say, honest, you always have to go back to what really makes sense to you and what does not. Now, you can surrender your authority. You can say, well, I'm giving it to church number Y or political party number two. But that is, you have authority. You have the free will to surrender it. But in the end, you're going to have to realize that you're going to be disappointed in doing that. And you say, well, what makes sense to me really? That, I think, is the bedrock of whatever new religion is going to come out of our times.
I think a key to this is, you know, you have authority when you relinquish authority. It seems like all the great teachers of the world, you know, whether it be Jesus, the Christ, or the Buddha, you know, never spoke on their own authority, right? They said, I have myself, can do nothing, said Jesus. It's the Christ within that does the work, you know, the Father within me. The Buddha said the same thing, you know, are you a God? Are you an angel? What are you? And he said, I'm not none of those things. I'm awake. And it's almost like they realize that they of themselves, they are empty, right? So it's because they're empty, like the empty cup, that they can be filled. And I think it's true in our own lives. You know, the deepest direct experience comes when we humble ourselves, right? When we know nothing. I think Socrates said that, didn't he? He had no understanding of anything, really. Hopefully that's why he could teach a little bit, you know? So it seems that self-emptying kenosis or whatever is a really important hallmark of this stuff.
Yeah, that's very true. And Now, it's always coming back to sort of, well, what do I really know about this, and what am I taking on speculation or faith or whatever? And I don't think there's any definitive point. I mean, you will come to some conclusions in your life, but it's always continuing, never ending process.
Right, which is a joy, really, right? Because it's to stay teachable, I think, is one of the most important things that we can do. You know, if we think we have it all sewn up, we're kind of dead, aren't we? We're ossified, you know?
That's definitely true. And, you know, the people who are the most open-minded, most willing to consider many points of the view, are the ones who seem most alive and most genuine, and the ones who look through everything through the lenses of their particular dogma often seem dead.
Right.
And go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, you have a chapter on that, you know, the chapter on particularity, the idea that God would choose, say, one person in history to reveal the whole truth to, seems, you know, aberrant, really. And yet we take it as mm-hmm. part of the doctrine of Christianity. And there's other religions that, you know, subscribe to that same idea, too, that in a particular time, at a particular moment, with a particular person, you know, that was the ultimate revelation. And to me, that can't be true, you know, because God is no respecter of persons, number one, says Jesus. And so we're all, at the gateway here. We're all on the threshold of realizing this, right? In fact, Jesus says, you know, the things I've done, you can do too. The kingdom of heaven is within you. You know, the usual unity hallmarks here that are not usually quoted in more fundamentalist circles because they don't fit in with their theology. So I'm glad you had that chapter, because sometimes you can go crazy thinking maybe I've got it wrong. You know, I'm not really following the true way, but the true way is in the heart, right? It's not in a system.
Well, one thing.
We're at the break. I'm sorry to cut
That's
you
all
off.
Right. Good.
Let's take a break. I'm with Richard Smoley. We're talking about his wonderful book, A Theology of Love. Join us after these messages from Unity.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show in this series that we're doing on aspects of love. I'm with Richard Smoley talking about his new book. It's called A Theology of Love, Reimagining Christianity Through a Course in Miracles, a spirituality based on love, not fear. And I think you'll find this book very fascinating and useful. It's very erudite in the sense there's lots of references to different traditions, esoteric and otherwise. But it's also very clear about its thrust towards the need to move away from that old way of thinking, which limits us, fear-based, to the more expansive way of love, and goes into some detail on that. And a lot of it based around the Course in Miracles. And of course, if you're a Unity person, you might be familiar with the Course in Miracles, because a lot of Unity churches teach it or have study groups looking at it. And, you know, I find it very useful, especially the workbook, which poses questions that can really help us go deep within our own spiritual experience and question things about what's reality and what isn't. But I also have some concerns about it. And I thought Richard's going to be the right one for me to ask some of these questions. I don't want to spend too long on it, because I want to move on to our looking forward to a new theology for this new age that we're in. And you mentioned some of these things already, Richard, in the book, you know, that it's very masculine-centered. He uses Christian terminology almost exclusively. Even some terminology that Jesus never used, and yet Jesus seems comfortable with using that terminology when he comes back and talks through the author of the book, and also this sort of, to me, a little pompous poetic verbiage that it's used in it. So I guess, you know, you could say, well, these aren't very deep questions. You know, okay, you don't like the way it's written or phrased. How would you counter that? You know, was it written at a time when we did, you know, use masculine terms, I guess?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was the that was quite obviously why they did it. You could rewrite the course in gender neutral language, but a lot of things rewritten in gender neutral language tend to be rather lip sounding. And many women have taken objection to it, and you know, many women have, just substituted God the Mother for God the Father and so on.
Right.
I think that's
right.
Perfectly legitimate. The use of Christian language, that is very specifically, I think, intended as a corrective to traditional Christian theology. And if you accept the hypothesis that it was dictated by Jesus, it would be kind of his corrective of all of the misinformation about him that's accumulated over the last 2,000 years. A point I make in my book, Theology of Love, is that why are we stuck with Christianity? We're not stuck with it, but it is what we've been kind of given to start with. We live in a civilization that was based on Christianity. Our concepts, our terms, our myths are all based on it. This does not, as I try to emphasize in the book, does not mean that it is superior to any other religions. It does mean that we have to come to terms with it in a way that we don't have to come to terms with Taoism or Islam or Judaism. There are other cultures that have to come to terms with those, and they'll do it as we can. But we have to do something with Christianity and say, well, how much are we going to leave behind? How much are we going to take on? And I think the course was meant to do that. As far as the third point, the literary language, we are getting into a kind of a matter of literary taste here. It does use rather exalted language. A lot of it can be scanned as blank verse, iambic pentameter. I personally like that, and I find it generally inspiring, and I respond well to it. I could see that someone might find it a bit highfalutin, and to that all I can say is, you know, it really is a matter of taste.
Right. Well, I'm not too concerned about those, but I do have a couple of things that concern me, and that is its apparent dualism. You know, we're putting up the real against the unreal, you know, the mind opposed to the body, reality versus illusion, and we've moved from error thinking to error making, it seems. You know, I'm all in favor of the fact that we have error thinking. You know, we don't see the world as it is because we're in that sort of mirror box, you know, and it's sort of illusory what we create. However, you know, the course to me seems to jump to this error making that the whole universe is not real, the body is not real. So eventually that's going to disappear. Sure, the body's transitory, it's full of change, but everything in the universe is full of change, it seems to me. And quantum physics seems to be expressing that, right? We have tendencies towards things, but there is nothing solid. This could be the genius of spirit, you know, rather than seeing it as a problem that things change. Thank God they do, you know, because if we didn't have death, we couldn't sustain the planet, you know. So rather than see death as an illusion, I see it as part of the process of regeneration, you know, that things change. And yet they say, as the French say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So, you know, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there isn't that dualism, but it seems to stray, you know, in its desire to wake us up from illusory ways of thinking. It creates a universe that is inherently kind of wrong or something, and I just can't subscribe to that.
Well, I think it would be more accurate to say it posits that we cognize a universe. that's all wrong.
Right.
It goes back to what I said at the very beginning. You know, there's this deep sense that life is problematic, it's suffering, it's whatever. You know, the Course is saying this is a problem with our conceptual structures, and these conceptual structures go far, far deeper than any kind of psychologist of any even conventional stripe, even Jung, I think, wanted to go to. We have made kind of a mistake about the world, and this mistake leads us to imagine the world as it is. And it is a result of kind of fear. We wanted to, as it were, see what it was like to live without God, and we got what we wanted because people very often feel they're going through day to day living without God. Where is God? Whatever. Well, in a sense, this is the condition we set up for ourselves, but it often feels like a trap, and many people feel trapped in it, as you can see. So the problem is not that the world or the universe is wrong or bad, which the Course does not say, but our minds, at a very, very deep level, are structured to cognize it in this way of attack and defense, good and bad, dualism, whatever. And it is a very subtle point. I think a lot of people who study the Course don't realize it, and because this goes far, far beyond, it's a deeper coma even than a coma.
Right.
As there's a chapter in the book of my book about it, which is which talks about the cloud of unknowing. There is this kind of cloud of darkness that seems to separate us from the world. And this is, there are terms for this. Tibetan Buddhism has very specific terms for this state. And it is kind of this that you have to, as the mystical text, the Cloud of Unknowing says, you have to pierce this somehow. This is a very, very deep and long process. It can seem insurmountable. The Course posits an answer that is, say, forgiveness. And having written a book on forgiveness called The Deal, A Guide to Radical and Complete Forgiveness, I know the problems that are inherent when people hear the word. Forgive, why should I forgive? Who am I to forgive anyway? You know, the usual rubbish that goes on in your head. So to sum up all of this in a more practical point of view, you could say forgive, or in a little lighter way, you can take the world less seriously than you do, because it is not as it appears to you. This doesn't mean rejecting anything. It doesn't mean dualism. It doesn't mean hatred of the body, which the Course does not teach. It means, you react to this world you see, you think this is going on. It's really not that way. The very first step in realizing that is to say, it may not be that way, and maybe I'm getting upset for completely wrong reasons.
Right. And, as a course in spiritual psychology, I think it's very, very helpful, actually. It's just when it veers towards a sort of a Gnostic dualism that they have a problem with it. And maybe that's not there. Maybe I'm reading into it. You mentioned humor, and you quote Rabbi Shapiro in the book too, that we have to become holy rascals, which I like. That's another thing that there's not much humor in the course, is there? It's kind of serious. Maybe there is an inherently a joy, because ultimately it talks about the supremacy of love and forgiveness, atonement, etc. I wouldn't say it pontificates, but it's got a like you mentioned, a highfalutin way of presenting things, mm-hmm. sometimes, quite serious.
And that,
that's fine, though.
I mean, there are elements of if you don't want to say humor, you could say wit in it, as it points out. The Bible says that a deep sleep fell upon Adam, but nowhere does it say he woke up.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And, you know, shall we say incisive, but yeah, it isn't a laugh riot or anything like that. So
yeah,
you have
right.
to take it and leave it.
Well, maybe
that.
We don't need it to be so. It stands for itself. So yeah, let's move on. I don't want to belabor that the criticism too much, because I think there's a lot of good in the course for folks, and you know, it's quite profound. And if you study the workbook or the text or whatever, you'll find some gems, I think, for anybody who has never come across A Course in Miracles before. I know when I first read it back in the early 80s, it was the workbook that really grabbed me, because some of the questions there, you know, took me is that true? But once I understand what they were saying, you know, what it was saying, I understood, oh yeah, okay. I'm projecting a lot of stuff. I'm making generalizations, or I'm thinking things that aren't really necessarily true. And it's helpful to move from that that place of sort of surface conditioning to a deeper awareness of being present, right? Being aware. I love the idea of the holy instant, for instance, which is very much part of, you know, being here now. You know, Eckhart Tolle's teaching on the only places now, and it has a very profound awareness of who we are. You know, I think Sri Nagasadatta Maharaj, you know, and those teachers, Sailor Bob Adamson is another one of my favorites. He says, you know, what about this moment is missing? You know, there's nothing missing right now. It's only when we start to think about it that we cloud it with our needs and our desires from the past or the future. But actually right now is kind of okay. You know, it's fine if we could be here all the time, yeah. Right?
Well, you know, there's another element in that. We talk about esotericism or think about esotericism, those ideas that we just talked about that you just mentioned now, which seem very common and are almost cliches, were highly esoteric, say in 1950. If you had said that in any kind of radio show then, people would simply not know what you meant.
Yeah.
But a lot of those ideas that were so esoteric have become popularized. Be here now, the power of now, so on, so on, so on. So to go back to the idea of a new age, this is maybe evidence of it. A lot of things that were formerly esoteric are now becoming publicized. And sometimes they become publicized, they become cliches and people sneer at them, but still it's progress.
Well, let me read through some of the statements that you put forward as, you know, a tentative way to approach a new spirituality, a new age, as you say, of the Holy Spirit. One is an internalization of the divine, right? It's an inner process rather than seeking authority from without. Inner experience as the center of religion, which follows up on that. Scripture used for advice and inspiration, not as a source of dogma. A transformed clergy who hopefully guide us towards that interior awareness, a more flexible use of ritual, restoration of beauty to religion. I think beauty and humor go together. You know, they're qualities that are joyous and uplifting, right, rather than the heaviness and seriousness of some things. Humanistic ethics, ethics that actually work, a recognition that many forms of religious thought and representation are undergirded by certain universal truths, which is some of the work that people like Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama are doing. A more rigorous theology. In other words, it's okay to really think through these things. Resilient worldviews, recognition of the limits of science, because as you mentioned in the book, we've sort of deified science now as the new god in our world. Mm-hmm. So there's some of the lists here, all of which I can subscribe to. And what I like about them all is they're open-ended, right? There's not saying that it has to be like this. Imagine if we had this more expansive view of our own spiritual endeavor. Where would that lead us? Is well, any, I think one particular one or some that you'd like to emphasize particularly?
You mean of those points?
Yeah.
Well, I think probably the most overlooked of them all is beauty. This is a strange situation in the United States today because this is by far the wealthiest civilization in the history of the world. And yet, look at our landscape, it's just ugly. I mean, forget, I'm not even talking about environmental degradation, which is, you know, quite a serious matter, but the buildings are so awful. You know, I live in a Midwestern suburb, God, it's like this three-dimensional linoleum. There's a repeating pattern, you know. Well, there's a Pizza Hut, there's a McDonald's, there's a Starbucks. There's very, very little architectural beauty. People do plant nice gardens and that kind of thing around their houses. But there's so little interest in beauty. It's all, well, it's let's just get the most economically convenient, cheapest thing up for our purposes. And, well, maybe we have to enhance it a little bit to, like, get the customers in. But there's no real beauty. As I said in the book, you know, a church is, you know, often looks like a veterans hall with a big cross at the back. So I think this is something more than the others that I want to emphasize because it's the most neglected. Many of the other points I've mentioned, which you've mentioned, of course, I agree with, but they've been discussed and opened more than that particular one. Why is there such this almost brutal indifference to physical beauty of any kind? Look at the art of the Renaissance, and look at the kind of art we're producing. Look, you know, and look at the kind of art the big money is paying for. It's just awful. Why is this? And I think if some, I'm not talking about going back and putting, you know, Greek sculptures all over everything. That was a time in the past. But, you know, a re-envisioning of beauty that simply has not been done. And its beauty has been spurned and cursed very often by the artists, most of all. Many artists make a profession of making the ugliest, most revolting images possible. And this does have educational value, kind of, you know, shows the limits of our, you know, conceptual discourse and all that rubbish. But maybe it's time for artists to actually go back to beauty.
Well, this is
that
one is, of my
so that
big,
is the one I...
Yeah, I can see you're on a roll with this subject, and I kind of agree with you. You know, if you go to Europe, for instance, you just don't see the sprawl and the junk strips that you see in America. You know, it always amazes me that they can have a large population and satisfy all their economic needs, but without this horrible, you know, junk strip of houses and buildings that are only going to last for a few years, and they'll be torn down, and another one will replace it. We just spoil our highways, you know, for miles each end of town with these endless buildings. And I don't understand it myself. You know, luckily, if you escape from the road into the countryside, you know, then it's you return to normalcy again or relative normalcy. It's only along those edges. But somebody told me I was on my way to India. I was in Afghanistan and the Spanish guy walked around a roundabout with me many times, and he talking about spirituality, and we ended up talking about America, and he said there's only one really good thing about America. I said, okay, what's that? Convenience. He said everything is about convenience, and I think that's why we have all these strips, right? Because they're convenient. You can get your car to them. And everything's done for convenience and selling things, right? We're the ultimate consumer society. But I totally agree with you. There seems to be no awareness that it's one thing to save our national parks and all that, and that's a wonderful thing. But you know, beauty is all around us, and we have to live hopefully in a beautiful environment wherever we are, right? And enjoy it as such, and not despoil it.
Yeah, nice to have a little more human-created beauty. I mean, one reason that this landscape is so architecturally desolate is the United States is really not completely settled yet.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of things, towns are very new. Things are going up. In a sense, nobody has really decided where things ought to be. So, well, we're going to put this up now, and maybe nobody will be coming here in 30 years. So why should we build it to last anything more than 30 years?
Right.
There are, you know, major cities are exceptions, but a lot of America is like that. So that's another facet of it, which is ultimately nobody's fault.
Right. Well, I must say there's a counter in my mind, because yesterday I went to the Fort Worth Stock Show and the new Dickies Arena, and they created an amazing landscape there with a huge ramp and all kinds of things where you can look out over the city, and it's all done in sort of the faithful to the Art Deco original buildings that were built back in the 30s and the 40s, and but very nicely done. And I felt, you know, proud for the city, proud for them for integrating. There's a beautiful wooden plaza that is planted with lovely trees, etc. So, you know, there is some movement forward now, I think, in urban architecture to take into account the, you know, the livability of a place, you know, the fact that we want beauty around us. So I've seen that movement in the last 3 years. We've had moves to clean up streets, you know, that were just totally ugly, and they planted them and shifted the traffic pattern and whatnot, made them a much more pleasant place to be. So it can be done, right? I think this, people are beginning to be aware of that need for beauty.
Yeah, and it as you say, it's being done in some areas, so it's not all bleak picture.
Right. So, okay, we have about 2 minutes left. What would you like to convey to us that we haven't already covered? What's the most important thing we need to know?
Well, we've covered so much that it's a difficult thing to pull out. Well, I guess I will talk a little bit about science, because that did come up. Science is in a major crisis, and this is obvious, although it's not being made obvious. The bedrock of science is replicability. That is, you can replicate an experiment and prove it to be true. I made this experiment. The article describing it as a recipe, and you follow this recipe, and you'll get the same results. Well, that is rapidly being found to be false. Many experiments are not replicated, and then when they are, the replicator doesn't get anything like the same results. That is a big kind of crack in the foundation of science. The other is that science has shown, to its own satisfaction, that our experience of the world is dictated by our nervous systems, our brains and our nerves. And this gives us a very, very limited amount of information about the world. Bees can see colors, we can't. Dogs can hear sounds, we can't. So if you grant that, you cannot turn around and say that the evidence of this sensory experience is some kind of complete authority about the way the world really is.
Right.
Science has been trying to say both, and it's gotten away with it. But it's at a point where it can no longer get away with it. And as you say, now science is starting to sound rather mystical. Consciousness is the basis of the universe. You see that in, you know, scientific statements now. I wrote a book called The Dice Game of Shiva, How Consciousness Creates the Universe. It was published in 2009. And I see that idea much, much more widely accepted and disseminated now, 10 years later, than it was at the time. So
yes.
Science is in for an enormous upheaval, and I think even quantum physics is just kind of a rough kind of...
So much teacher. More to learn.
Yeah.
Folks, we're at the end of the show.
Step in the direction.
Next week, Stephen Post is with me to talk about God and love on Route 80. But I want to thank Richard Smoley for being with me. What a great show. What a great book. Get hold of it, folks. A Theology of Love. And thank you, Richard, for being with us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.